There's just something about being the person at the front of the room that will cause everybody to start thinking of you with way more authority than they ever did before.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another episode of Famous Failures, where I interview the world's most interesting people about their failures and what they learned from them. I'm your host, Ozan Marol. Today's guest on the show is Susan Cain. Susan is the author of two books. The first is called Quiet, The Secret Strengths of Introverts, and the second, Quiet, The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking. A second book was translated into 40 languages. It's in its seventh year on the New York Times bestseller list, and it was named the number one best book of the year by Fast Company magazine, which also named Susan one of its most creative people in business. Susan's writing has appeared in the New York Times, The Atlantic, The Wall Street Journal, among many other publications. Her record smashing TED Talk has been viewed over 20 million times and was named by Bill Gates as one of his all-time favorite talks. In the interview, Susan and I cover quite a bit of ground. We discuss why Susan left a high-powered career as a Wall Street attorney to become a writer, what advice she has for other people who are thinking about making a similar career transition, how she decided to write a book about introversion, why all literary agents, except for one that Susan approached, turned down her book idea, what Susan did after her book editor told her that her draft manuscript was terrible and advised her to start over from scratch, how Susan copes with the demands of publicity as an introvert, how introverts can survive and even thrive in networking events and conferences, how to move beyond small talk to deeper conversation, and so much more. Before I play the interview, as always, if you're enjoying the show, please take a moment to subscribe to it on whatever platform you might be listening to and leave a rating for it on either iTunes or Google Play. That goes a really long way in alerting other people who might be interested in these episodes. And if you'd like to keep in touch with me, you can sign up for my weekly newsletter. It's called The Weekly Contrarian. It goes out to nearly 14,000 subscribers every Thursday and shares with them an article that I wrote that week, along with recommendations for other books, other articles, tools, gems, really anything that challenges conventional wisdom and helps you look at the world a little bit differently. And if you sign up, you'll also get my free ebook, The Contrarian Handbook, 8 Principles for Innovating Your Thinking. You can sign up for that by going over to weeklycontrarian.com. Without further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Susan Cain, and thank you, as always, for listening. Susan, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's so great to be here.
I've been really looking forward to this conversation for so many reasons, and we'll get into them as we go through the interview. But I first want to start with your background, because you had this huge career pivot. You worked for 7 years as an attorney on Wall Street before deciding that a legal career wasn't for you. What prompted you to reach that conclusion, and how did you decide to leave the law?
Oh my gosh, this really is one of those proverbial, like, how much time do you have questions? Because there are so many different ways to answer it, you know, starting with that I had wanted to be a writer since the time I was 4 years old, and had really completely forgotten about that dream during the time that I was a lawyer, and got really into practicing for a while there. But the whole time that I was doing it, I felt like an imposter, and not out of imposter syndrome, but because I actually was an imposter. Like it really was not the right profession for me.
You said you felt that it wasn't the right career for you. Like, how do you describe that feeling? How did you know that?
Well, I mean, there were so many things. Like, you know, for one thing, I was practicing corporate law. I entered the practice not knowing the difference between a stock and a bond, but I was really into it. So I would go home every weekend, and I had this little dictionary called Wall Street Words, and I would study the dictionary and try to learn bond math and all these things. But there was just this feeling, like I would see that my colleagues were really excited if they were working on a transaction that was on the front page of the Wall Street Journal, and I didn't care at all about that. So there were sort of indicators like that. And then I had been practicing for a few years, and I had a kind of turning point moment when I came across this book called Do What You Are, which helped you take the Myers-Briggs personality test. And figure out what your personality type was based on that test, and then use that information to think about what was the right career for you. And I took the test, and I was Myers-Briggs language. I was an INFP, and I turned to the careers for that type, and the careers were all like writer, social worker, psychologist, clergy person, you know, so this constellation of careers that immediately felt like, oh yeah, that's me. They did not resemble what I was doing at all. So yeah, that was just one of those moments. But I think that often when we have those moments, it takes a long time to act on them. You know, it can take years to act on them. And that's how long it took me. I mean, I remember going home and thinking really deeply about it, but it wasn't like the next day I handed in my resignation or anything like that. It was more like just becoming really aware of a kind of disconnect. It's possible that I might never have done anything about it, or that it would have taken decades even, but I was on partner track. And a few years after that, one of the senior partners in my firm came into my office one day, and he said that I was not going to be put up for partner that year, as I had expected. I still don't know to this day, was he saying, you're never getting put up for partner, or just not this year? All I know is that I was simultaneously like crestfallen and embarrassed and liberated, you know, all at once. About an hour later, asked if I could take a leave of absence, and I left the firm that afternoon and never came back. I never practiced law again after that.
I want to go back to something you said earlier, and this is in part for the benefit of those in the audience who are thinking about perhaps pivoting in their own careers. It takes a long time to act on these urges. So you feel perhaps that your chosen career isn't the right one for you, but you stick it out for longer than you should. And I want to dig a little bit deeper into that point, because it's something that I've thought quite a bit about, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on this as well, as to why that is the case. One thing that I saw, at least in the legal world, but I think this probably applies in diverse fields as well in other fields, is that we tend to build up our significance or our identity around what we're doing. So we tell ourselves a story, and it's a story that I've certainly told myself at various points in my life, that, you know, I'm a serious lawyer, or I'm a serious professor, and serious lawyers don't give up a high power legal career to go become a writer, or serious law professors don't start podcasts for a general audience. And once you tell that story to yourself enough times, even if you feel like there is something wrong with what you're doing, or that it doesn't feel quite right, it becomes really hard to risk your significance in a way and pivot away from what you're doing.
I think, yeah, there is that story that you have of yourself, and it's not clear what the alternative story is going to be. So if you give up A to go and do B, or if you give up A to go and do I don't know what, which I think is actually how it usually happens. It's not always clear what the pathway is going to be. It's not only that you're giving up your identity, a specific identity, you're kind of giving up any identity or any professional identity. I remember just this feeling of being kind of in free fall right after. And that can be scary. And I think there's also the feeling of all the time and maybe financial investment and energy and professional network and all of it, you know, everything that you've invested into career path A, you kind of feel like it's for nothing. And that's a really hard feeling. When I met my husband, I think it was our second date or our third date, we had tickets to go see a movie, but we were at a bar and we were having a good time, and we would have had to leave that bar prematurely to go see this movie to which we had tickets. And I was getting ready to go, and he said, no, it's a sunk cost. We already paid for the tickets. Let's just stay where we're having a good time. And I loved that. And I loved that whole approach to life. It's not a coincidence, actually, that I met him right after, or I don't know, a year or two after I had left the law. Because I think I was in the process of shifting to that approach to life of like, just because you invested time in A, if A isn't the right path, forget it, you know, figure out something different. I think being able to do that is really important. But I'll also say that it was really hard to do. And I was young then, and I didn't have a mortgage, and I didn't have kids that I was supporting, you know, even without those kinds of responsibilities. it was scary to make that shift. I don't want to be Pollyanna-ish about what people are feeling, just from a practical point of view, about making a career change. And I really am a big believer when making those changes of having a plan B and having a backup plan and having a financial cushion and all those different things, if for no other reason than just to make the whole experience more pleasant and less stressful, especially if you're leaving to do something creative. I don't think that creative projects work when you're really stressed out about paying the rent. I think that you want to have as much emotional freedom around your creative projects as possible. And that's really only possible once you've figured out what the financial cushion is going to be. So I think that's actually the first step.
So you mentioned you were in a free fall right after you took a leave of absence, which turned out to be a permanent leave of absence of sorts from the law.
Yes.
So how was the transition like, and what was your plan B if things didn't work out?
I mean, for one thing, by the way, just the fact of calling it a leave of absence was a huge plan B, because I knew I could go back even if I didn't want to and didn't think I was going to. So that was huge, just in terms of psychological freedom. But what I immediately did once I was on this leave of absence, it wasn't like I was thinking I was going to be a writer. I had forgotten all about writing at that point. So I was just thinking I was going to travel and hang out. But within a few days, I found myself signing up for a class in creative nonfiction writing at NYU. And I showed up at that class, and that was another one of these life epiphany moments, sitting in that class on the first night and feeling like I had truly arrived at where I was supposed to be. Never in my wildest dreams did I expect to earn a living from writing. So the first thing I did at that point was figure out, okay, how am I going to actually make a living, but in a free enough way where I can organize my life around writing, but have my income come from somewhere else. So I did a couple things, including I started a little consultancy where I was teaching people negotiation skills that I had learned during my legal career. And that was something that I could do in a freelance way. Often in the evenings, I would hold these classes, and then I could write during the day. So things like that.
And holding the negotiation skills class, I assume this goes back to your point about not putting the financial burden on the creative side of your life?
Yeah. Oh, very much so. Very much so. In fact, you know, during that time when I got so into writing, I actually went, there was this famous class at the time in New York City for people who aspired to be freelance writers. And I went to that class full of hopes and expectations for it. And I actually hated it, because I saw that all these people who were trying to make their living from freelance writing, which the way it was narrated in the class, it just seemed like a life of constant hustling and stress around your writing. You know, this was before I had ever started to write quiet. I was just writing all different stuff. I wrote a play and a memoir and stories and lots of things. And I never tried to publish any of it. It was all just one big fun thing that I was doing. And it was really important to me to start that way with no financial or professional pressure around it.
And even after success comes, I think this is a common story across creatives. Many creatives tend not to make their, say, writing their only source of income, because it just puts so much pressure on the art, which goes back to something you said earlier. When you're under that financial pressure, it makes it really hard to be creative. The example I read recently was, and I'm going to mispronounce his last name, but Salman Chinani, who's the author of The School for Good and Evil, is going to be a major motion picture from Universal soon. But even after that major movie deal, he still does tutoring for high school students on the side. And he says, wow. You know, my friends can't understand it, but it's the only way I know how to write without feeling like it's a matter of life and death.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. And by life and death, he means economic life
and
death?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Wow. Wow. That's so interesting. And I totally understand it. I really do. I mean, especially as someone who, you know, I'm working on another book now, but each one takes me years. And I really only like to work on books if I feel some burning urge to do it, you know. So I never want to be in a position where I feel like I have to churn out another book every 2 years just to have income coming in.
And how did you come up with the burning urge, to use your words, to write about introversion?
I don't know. It's kind of a funny thing, because as I said, I was writing so many different things when I first started writing, and I never really tried to publish any of it. And then I came to this book project, and somehow I thought, okay, this is the one that I'm gonna do. I don't know why it was that was the one, but I do know that the drive for writing it was that was a story I had been living all my life. It's something I'd been thinking about in one way or another since I was very, very small. I didn't have the words for it when I was a kid, but I've been thinking about it forever. I will say, when I first started working on it, I thought that it was a kind of odd and idiosyncratic project. So I hoped to make a book out of it, but at the beginning, I had no idea it was going to become this gigantic thing. It felt much more like an idiosyncratic personal project.
So for those who are listening, when it comes to nonfiction books, the typical path is to actually not write the book. You first write a book proposal, and then you find an agent, and then your agent takes your book proposal, you go back and forth, and once you finalize it, then the agent takes the book proposal and takes it to publishers. And once you have a publisher in place, it's at that point that you start writing the book. How did that process look like for you?
Well, it was a lot like that. Okay, so I told you that the first thing I did after I left law was I took that creative nonfiction class at NYU. So that class was great, and a bunch of us from the class stayed together for some years in a writer's group. When I got the idea for the introversion book, one of the members of my writer's group, who later became herself a novelist, she's also an ex-lawyer, by the way, and now she's a novelist. Anyway, so she was a publishing lawyer, and so she knew a guy named Richard Pine, who is our fellow agent. And she said, you know, I think when you're ready with the proposal for that book, I think that I know the right agent for it who's going to be interested. And gosh, was that a lucky thing, because I put the proposal together just the way you were describing, and I sent it to Richard, and I sent it to four other really excellent agents, and the other four all came back with responses like, well, I like the writing, but I think this idea is not very commercial. Could you come back with another topic? Richard was the only one who instantly got it. And I will tell you that is a lesson that has stayed with me for the rest of my life, because the knowledge of how subjective this stuff is, all of these agents were people at the top of their fields with really good judgment and great track records. And the fact is, it doesn't matter, you know, that because this stuff is subjective, it's really a matter of finding the right person for any given project and not taking the nose too seriously along the way. I mean, really, from the very beginning, it was kind of crazy. I remember going to his office to meet with him, and it was like a cinematic dream come true. You know, here I was, like, I wanted to be a writer all my life, and now I'm sitting in the office of this high-powered agent, and he's saying, okay, you know, I'm going to be pitching this as the big new book of the year. And he had so much belief in it. And I remember he introduced me to his partner at the time, and well, still his partner, and his partner came in, and we said hello and shook hands, and the partner did that sort of we will now manage client expectations thing of saying, okay, well, we have high hopes for this book, but of course you never know what's going to happen until you actually show it to the publishers. And then the partner left the office, and Richard said to me, don't listen to that. This is going to be huge. So he just had such courage of his convictions. It was amazing.
That's amazing. Well, I think, you know, in hindsight, to me at least, it appears so obvious the appeal of the book, in no small part because of the content, of course, but also, you know, most book editors who work at these publishing houses who are in charge of vetting book proposals are introverts themselves. So it probably appealed to them.
Yes, you were so smart. That's exactly what happened. Yeah, there was this gigantic auction for it. And, you know, I had to go around to the different publishing houses and meet with all the editors and the PR people, the marketing people, you know, and I was sitting in like boardroom after boardroom with all these editors talking for the first time publicly about being introverts themselves and how much this proposal had spoken to them. So yes, that's exactly what happened.
I've never told the story publicly, but your book Quiet resonated with me for very similar reasons. I'm an introvert, and I remember reading the book. This was, I think, summer of 2012. So if I recall correctly, so your book had come out in January of that year. So I picked it up that summer, and I was at this big conference for law professors, and there's hundreds of people there, just sort of an introvert's nightmare. And so, and I'm just starting out, so I'm trying to network and schmooze, and I'm terrible at small talk, and every conversation I have is just so exhausting. And so every, you know, hour, or even like every 45 minutes, I would either run into the restroom to take a breath, or I would go up to my room where I had your book, and I would read your book, and it spoke to me, because, you know, for the vast majority of my life, I thought there was something wrong with me. I didn't think of myself as witty or a good conversationalist. And then just reading your book, especially in the midst of this conference that was designed for extroverted people, was such a godsend. Not only that, but it also planted the seed in me about the power of writing books like Quiet, who appeal to general audiences. And at the time, I was only writing academic articles that only about, you know, 20 other people in my field would read, and the rest of the world would sort of ignore what we were saying, of course, because we were legal academics. That seed planted in 2012, it took a, you know, a long time to mature, but really that was the inception for why I eventually embarked down a path of going into publishing. And our mutual friend Adam Grant was kind enough to refer me to Richard Pine, and why I started this podcast. So all of these amazing things that are happening in my life right now really date back to that book. So thank you so much for writing it.
Wow. Oh my gosh. Well, that story gives me such goosebumps, and I feel so honored by it. Thank you. Thank you for telling it.
In writing about introversion, ironically, put you into the spotlight. So you gave this TED Talk in 2012 that became one of the best viewed TED Talks of all time. Bill Gates lists it among his favorites. So as an introvert, how has being in the spotlight, and of course the book itself became this huge mega success, how has being in the spotlight affected your life? How do you balance the demands of publicity with your need to be alone?
It's a funny thing, because in terms of the speaking itself, I used to be really uncomfortable with it. That's really putting it mildly. I used to be flat out terrified by it. And now the speaking is no problem. You know, I'm quite comfortable with it. And I have, ironically, this career as a public speaker, and I go around and I talk to God knows how many companies and organizations and conferences about how to harness the talents of their introverts and how to help introverted and extroverted teams work well together. And so, gosh, I would not have predicted that 10 years ago. You know, people will often say to me, oh, okay, well, now that you're doing that, you obviously have turned into an extrovert. I'm like, no, you know, what happens is that all of us, introverts, extroverts, we're all acquiring new skills all the time. And, you know, you kind of layer those new skills on top of your personality, and it might end up looking like a different picture, but the underlying person is still the same. Yeah, I am out there in public quite a bit, but in terms of the overall life that I craft for myself, I still have quite a bit of alone time / quiet time with people who I know well and love. So my typical day is still like getting up and exercising and writing, and then maybe doing an interview or two, like the one we're doing now, picking up my kids from school, and then hanging out with my family. Like that's a really typical day for me. And I punctuate those days with the days where I'm going and giving talks and stuff. And I'm working on another book right now, and when that book comes out, it's going to be another crazy rash of book tour mania, I'm sure, where my days will not look the way I just described. But in general, I still make a pretty big effort to structure my life that way.
And do you have any tips or any advice for the introverts who might be listening to this conversation when they do find themselves in, say, a conference or a networking event? These conferences tend to be set up for extroverts to thrive. And in a setting like that, how can an introvert survive, I want to say, but really beyond surviving, but thrive? Are there any strategies that you might think of?
You know, I spend a lot of time at those conferences because I speak at so many of them. So this is something I think about a lot. So one thing I would say, even if you're not inclined to be the speech maker, I actually would look for ways to put yourself more forward and maybe give a short talk or two. And I say this for two reasons. One is that there's just something weird about public speaking where it has such a disproportionate bang for the buck in terms of your career visibility. There's just something about being the person at the front of the room that will cause everybody to start thinking of you with way more authority than they ever did before. It's actually a lot easier to navigate a conference if you've been a speaker, because now suddenly you've got something to talk to everyone about, and everyone knows who you are, and they know a thing that you have in common, having listened to you. If you're just showing up at a conference, I always think of conferences in terms, I always think of my goal at a conference as being to find a few kindred spirits in the audience or among my fellow attendees. And I feel like once I've met a few of those kindred spirits, then my job is done, and I can go up to my hotel room and read that book or watch a movie or whatever. And then you keep in touch with those kindred spirits, and you do that enough times and you've now got a really amazing network. But just sort of going out there and, you know, asking people questions that are really designed to get to who they actually are. So not like, you know, what do you do for your company, but more like, what do you really love to do? Like, what do you enjoy most in life? What are your favorite things to do on a weekend? Like, questions like that will get people going more to the heart of things. And I think from there, you can kind of figure out who the kindred spirits are and really try to nurture those connections. But, you know, if you're not the person who loves working the room, I think it's really helpful to not think of that as being the goal. Like, there's other ways to find success.
I love that list of strategies. And if I can just add one more to that, don't be afraid to leave the room and go take a quick break in the restroom, which I do really frequently, just to take a breath and maybe splash some water in your face, which is what I do. I find that to be really refreshing, because it's just, for me at least, it's really hard to sustain the group dynamic. I'm fine with one-on-one conversations that go beyond small talk, but the moment I'm thrust into a group setting where small talk is the norm, then I become exhausted very, very quickly. And so just giving yourself the permission to just step outside for a moment, get some fresh air, or go into the restroom, or go up to your room for 5 minutes and come back down is really, really important. And it goes a long way.
Oh my gosh. I think that is such good advice. And I can tell you, because I'm the person at the conference who's known to be talking about introversion, people feel free to come up to me and tell me how they're truly feeling. I can't tell you how many people feel the way you just described and are using the strategies that you just described. I'm sure people looking at you who haven't heard you say this would be surprised to know it. And that's usually true of the people who come up to me. You know, it's not obvious in a lot of these cases that people are feeling this way, but so many people do. It's like really common. And once you know it, you know, when you go to the restroom, you'll see that half the restroom is populated by people who are using that strategy.
It's so true. I've seen that happen so many times. And what you're saying, even to my friends, I had a college friend visit 2 weekends ago. It was actually a group of people, and somehow introversion came up, and I said, well, you know, as an introvert, and I went on to say something else, and he said, wait a minute, wait, you're an introvert? And I said, yeah. He said, you know, he said he didn't even realize it, even though we had lived in the same house for 3-4 years, he just assumed, I think he, in his mind, he was equating being an introvert with being shy. And he didn't think of me as a shy person. But yeah, I said, yeah, I'm an introvert. I recharge by being alone. So what you're saying is so true, which is that people just don't realize that you might be an introvert, and there's so much power to speaking up about it. And then you find kindred spirits in the audience, as you said.
Yeah. You know, people would look at somebody like you who's done all these high powered things, and you're lecturing in front of students a couple times a week, and they think, well, an introvert can't do those things. But in fact, there are introverts doing those things all over the place. We just don't realize it. But I'm curious, you said he assumed being an introvert meant being shy. So do you feel that you are shy or not so much?
I don't feel that I'm shy, no, because if you do put me in a social setting, I am able to hold a conversation and I do speak up. If someone were to be a fly on a wall and sort of listen in on the conversation, they wouldn't think that I was shy. And I don't think of myself as shy either. I think the reason why I was telling my friend that I was an introvert is that it's really exhausting for me. This isn't true for all conversations, but especially in a group setting, it's just really exhausting for me to have that dynamic conversation without taking any breaks. So that's why I was telling him that, no, I'm not shy, but I am an introvert.
Yeah, and it's so funny because I think the reason you're saying group settings are more exhausting for you is because there's this strange norm about group conversation that you're not supposed to talk about anything real.
Right.
I don't know why that is. Because I think everybody wants to talk about something real. I don't know. It feels like in groups, it's either small talk or it's sort of tell a witty anecdote about something that happened to you last weekend. But it's like you don't really dig into the meat of things. And you're probably somebody who really likes meaty conversations.
Yeah, absolutely. Now I want to get down to I want to ask, what is your biggest fear right now, right? Like, what are you afraid of,
you know?
And just cut through the talk about the weather and everything else that tends to dominate group conversations and really get to know each other and expose vulnerability too. That's another part. If people are holding up their guard, then it becomes really hard to dig deeper. But if there's a way of everyone going around the table and showing their vulnerability, and I think that's how friendships deepen as well. This is something that I've been thinking about recently, but how do you form deeper connections with people? And I think one way of doing it is, as you said, move beyond the type of conversations that tend to dominate group discussions to really get to those deeper subjects that people don't often speak about.
I think in one-on-one friendship, the currency of the friendship, the thing that makes you become friends in the first place often is that you share confidences with the person that you're not telling everybody else.
Right.
And in a way, that's what marks you as friends. And the reason I was hesitating is because, without wanting to gender stereotype too much, I see that happening with friendships between women much more than with friendships between men. Like, my husband will often joke, I'll ask him, well, did you talk to your friend about such and such thing? And he'll say, oh no, guys don't talk about that. And I always think, I think that's such a shame for guys who feel that way.
It's true. And I think it probably applies to a lot of guys. I certainly feel that way. It's really hard for me to pick up the phone and call a guy friend and tell him about a rough day I had. I'm sure there's a multitude of reasons about why that's the case, societal conditioning being one of the many, but that's probably a conversation for another time. we're getting to the end of our time here, but I did want to ask you one last question because I love this story and I think it's one that our audience should hear. How long did it take for you to write Quiet?
Oh, yeah. Well, it took me a really long time. It took 7 years, and there were a number of reasons it took that long. Okay, so one reason was that I was giving birth to raising my two kids during that time. But honestly, I really don't think that was the primary reason, because I'm writing another book now, and it's taking me almost as long. So a second reason is that I write kind of like a Zamboni machine, those machines that clean the ice after hockey games. So you know how they kind of go around and around and around and around, polishing the thing up? So that's what I do, and I just can't help it, and it's how I like to do it. But with Quiet, specifically, on top of all that, I really didn't know what I was doing, because I had never published a word in my life, and I'd never written a full-length nonfiction thing before. So I wrote a first draft of it after, it took me about 2 years into my contract, and I gave it to my editor, and she said, this is terrible, and you should go back and start from scratch. And you might think that I would have been really upset by that pronouncement, but I was actually thrilled, because I knew that it was terrible. My biggest fear was that she was going to hold me to the delivery date in the contract, and I was going to have to go out in public with this terrible thing. So I was thrilled that she was giving me all the time that I needed to go make it good. I didn't have faith that I could do something amazing, but I had faith that I could at least, get it to a point that I was happy with. I just knew it was going to take me a while. And by the way, Richard, our agent, he also gave me that same candid feedback. Gosh, you really need people around you who give you that feedback. Because I had another editor at the time who was like, oh, yeah, this is fine. Keep publishing this.
I love that story for so many reasons. One, I think when we do get that kind of really hard-hitting critical feedback, our tendency is to push back and say, well, you're wrong, you know, here's why you're wrong, and I'm right, obviously. I've been working on this thing for 2 years, it's got to be good. That's one of the reasons why I love this story. You actually took the feedback to heart and went back and started from scratch, which is so hard to do. But second of all, I love the story because it's such a rare example, I think, in a society where we're so obsessed with shortcuts and life hacks and silver bullets. As Ben Horowitz says, there are no silver bullets. We're going to have to use a lot of lead ones instead.
So, I never heard that, but that's so good.
So you used a lot of lead bullets over that 7 year period, and it paid off in spades. So like I said, Quiet was a transformational book for me in more ways than one. It's the book that I've also gifted the most to other people. So thank you. Thank you so much for writing the book, and thank you so much for joining us. This was so much fun. If people want to find out more about you and check out Quiet, and we'll obviously put all of this in the show notes, so links to purchase Quiet as well as links to your newsletter and social media profiles. But for those who are just listening to this, where can they find you online?
I have a website. It's Quiet Revolution. So you can go there at quietrev.com, and there you can sign up for my newsletter. I post new things usually every week. You'll also be able to hear about my new book and podcast and projects and so on when they happen. On Twitter, I'm at Susan Cain. And if you go to Facebook and you put in author Susan Cain, you'll get to my author page. I'm also on LinkedIn. If you put in LinkedIn influencer Susan Cain, you will find me there too.
Excellent. We'll include links to all of that. Susan, thank you so much again for joining us.
Oh my gosh. Thank you so much for having me. It was really a total pleasure to talk to you.
Likewise. Thank you. Hi, everyone. Thanks for listening. Two things before you take off. First, if you don't want to miss out on future episodes of Famous Failures, please subscribe to the podcast on whatever platform you're listening on, and be sure to leave a review on iTunes or Google Play. Second, if you'd like to join thousands of others who receive a short email from me each Thursday with a list of articles, books, tools, quotes, and other gems that help you discover how extraordinary thinking produces extraordinary results, you can text my first name, which is Ozan, that's spelled O-Z-A-N, to 345-345. So once again, that's my first name, Ozan, O-Z-A-N, to 345-345. Or if you're in front of your computer, you can head over to ozanvarol.com and drop your email address. If you act now, you'll also get a free ebook called The Contrarian Handbook, 8 Principles to Innovate Your Thinking. As always, thank you for listening, and see you next time.